Yo everyone, welcome back. Brand new Techish, let's go. So there's two companies that recently both hit $100 billion valuation, both in the fintech space. We got Coinbase, Abadesi's arch enemy.
Coin bamboozled, more like.
And then we got Stripe, the e-commerce
giant. I got time for Stripe. I nearly worked there.
You got homies in the building, you know what I'm saying? So I was going to ask you, all right, actually, let me give you a bit more context in it.
Please.
So for the first 9 months of 2020, Coinbase did $140 million in profit. And that's before this new Bitcoin bonanza where it's gone through the roof.
Damn.
Stripe has processed an estimated 50% more payments than last year. And it's now valued at 3x its previous valuation at $115 billion. Now, if I said to you, you got a... Okay, I'm setting aside all personal feelings about Coinbase, yeah? Let's do that, yeah? Let's set aside all feelings here, yeah?
How can I?
Which two companies, if you had to put in a certain amount, let's say 10% of your net worth, you know what I mean, into one of these two companies and set it and forget it for 10 years, which two would you pick?
Stripe.
Not even a question.
No way.
What's your rationale behind Stripe over Coinbase?
First of all, Patrick and John, I mean, hello, badasses. They can like fly planes and stuff. They're like genius wunderkind kids.
Irish gangsters.
For realsies. I just think like philosophically, I see great leadership in the two, Patrick especially. Just definitely someone who feels very committed to the long term and like genuinely transforming the way commerce works. And yeah, I mean, my business is powered on Stripe. I know your business is powered on Stripe. What business isn't powered on Stripe? And I just think of things like PayPal, right? That Stripe was set up to basically challenge. PayPal's so ugly. And like, it's still around. It's still around. People are still using it. Like payments, you know, there's just such a legacy in that. Now, crypto, it's a bit like, you know, like when you first start learning economics, which was what I studied, you learn about how like the first like stock market crash or like, or bubble, was it like tulips in Holland?
Yeah, tulips in Holland.
And, you know, that's one of the first ways that you learn about hype and value and perceived value versus like real value. And like, there's just something about crypto right now. Don't get me wrong. We've spoken about it in previous episodes. Like, I do think there is like potential for blockchain and crypto in general, but the stuff that's been happening over the early months of 2021 feels unsustainable.
Right.
What do you do? You're coming from Coinbase, aren't you? You're getting those crypto kitties. You
know, I'm not sure. I think, listen, crypto is either going to be the next biggest thing of all time or it's going to zero. Like, there's no, I don't think two alternatives. Like, so I think it depends on how bullish you are on crypto. Because I think I see Coinbase almost like an index fund for crypto. Like, if you were like, I'm not sure what crypto to buy, and you were just like, listen, I'm just going to put, you know, 10% of my net worth on Coinbase.
A little bit here, a little bit there.
Yeah, because I think Coinbase is the market leader in terms of, you know, a crypto platform. I don't imagine any other platform superseding it. Like, it's got the kind of average investor on lock. Stripe, on the other hand, yeah, it's a much more safer bet. Like you said, I use it. It's, you know, like you said, PayPal is a very sticky product, and PayPal is not a great product. I know people that work there, and it's terrible, right? And Stripe has kind of come in and been much more user-friendly, much more beautiful. As a developer, you can always tell how, you know, what value the company places on developers by its docs. And like, sometimes certain companies' documentation is terrible. You're like, no TLC into this at all, whereas Stripe does. So I think I would concur with you. I think Stripe
You're on my side. So
we're in agreement.
Wow, that's a first.
Speaking of crypto, if I said the words NFT, like, what does that acronym mean to you? Does it ring a bell? Like, have you heard of it?
NFT. Are you dissing me? GTFO.
You know what? So, okay, last week, I think it was 2 weeks ago, we talked about SPACs. Maybe it was last week. So here's another acronym. So there's NFT, which stands for non-fungible tokens. So I saw this come up on my timeline not that long ago. I'm not really like a first mover on it, but essentially a non-fungible token is a digital asset that is on the blockchain that is unique and can't be replicated. So what people are doing now is they are putting pieces of art, digital photos, digital video that is like one of a kind. You place it on the blockchain, so the Ethereum blockchain, and people therefore bid on ownership of this, you know, digital art. So for example, there was one meme, the original owner or creator of the meme put it on the blockchain, and it's now been sold for $600,000 in an online auction.
I feel like a boomer now. What's happening out there?
The world is moving quickly, and it's something where even I struggle to wrap my mind around it, because essentially it's, if I had a like a JPEG, like an image for for example, you could send it to everybody and it's completely replicable and there'll be like a bajillion copies of it. But instead of doing that, I upload it to the blockchain and it's now an NFT. And that is essentially the original copy, the original Mona Lisa version, essentially. Now you can go to the art gallery, take a picture of the Mona Lisa off your phone, but there is only one Mona Lisa. And this essentially is meant to be, the original first copy mint edition and has ownership rights. So I don't know if you get the actual copyright for the actual image, but I'm guessing that you do. And people can bid on ownership. So it might come a point where an album might be put up as an NFT and just put on the blockchain, and if you want to bid on it, you can. That's the only way you can buy it, and there's one of a kind, and that's it.
But is it the physical thing or a representation of the thing?
So it depends, right? So you could imagine, so like, you know, like you might have like a sports card. So let's say like Michael Jordan is a basketball player, and then there's like a little trading card for Michael Jordan.
Yeah,
this would be the trading card. Do you get what I'm saying? Like this would be. So it could represent a physical thing in the real world, but at the moment it's mainly being done with digital art. So there's a lot of, if you are like a creative or an artist listening to the show, look into it, because there's a lot of money being made. There's a lot of artists that are just doing like little funny GIFs, little like digital art, and they're making bank because these bids are just going up and up and up. It might be a bit bubblicious at the moment right now. You know what I'm saying? But
yeah,
it's hot and it might be the future, because essentially the internet has made scarcity so hard with digital things. There's no scarcity. Music is not scarce.
Clone
you know, art, yeah, like pictures are not scarce. Like, you know what I'm saying? But this is now a way to kind of say there's a limited, you have limited access to this one like specific piece of art, for example. I don't know. It's interesting.
But with a meme, I can screenshot the meme. I can screen record the meme.
You can. The meme will still be shared, but that actually will mean that the NFT version of that meme will be worth more in value, because that represents the minted
original
public record of who owns that meme, basically.
But then it makes it feel like a collector's item, as opposed to a more regular asset class to hold your money in.
But then isn't that what great investments is? Like, a great investment is a collectible. Like, you might get like a really expensive bottle of wine, or like, I have a friend of mine.
I'll drink it.
Who bought some Japanese whiskey. I know you will. I have a friend of mine who bought some Japanese whiskey, and he knew it would go up in value, and it's like 5x in value because it's like super rare, right? Yeah, so these things happen. So yeah, everybody keep an eye on this. If you're a creative, if you're an artist, if you're a musician, look into NFTs. I think there might be something to it.
Wow.
And remember, Tekish was the plug if you do.
Where's the Tekish NFT? Put your face in one.
Let's do it.
I buy shares in Michael.
Negative value, though. It'd be like minus £100.
Let's see,
man. So Japan has hired a minister of loneliness. So this is based after more people died from suicide in October than the total number of COVID-19 deaths up to that point in 2020. So obviously it's a big deal. Like, what does this say about, and actually just to clarify, the UK previously had a loneliness minister, and I had no idea this person existed and this role was around. And I think three people have had that role and left. What does this say about the world that we're headed to? Like, that in the high income world, that we need somebody who's in charge of making sure that we're not lonely. Like, what's going on here?
Yeah, it's Japanese culture is super interesting to me. And, you know, I used to be obsessed with that Netflix show, Terrace House, which is like a reality show set in Japan. And there was a guy on that show whose business was to quit people's jobs for them, because it's so hard to quit your job in Japan. So he was basically like a mediation company. If I want to quit my job, it's so hard for me to admit that, to tell my boss, whatever. So I go hire this company, and then they have the conversation. I never go back again. They'll send their employees in to like clean up my desk and take everything out, so I don't have to deal with the like awkwardness and the shame. So that was like a very interesting observation to me. And then like another observation I made was like the way relationships unfolded in the show was just super interesting, because there's so much formality in that culture that there would be like so many steps and conversations building up literally to like a first kiss between two people in their 20s. And I've been very privileged to spend time in Japan. I went in 2012 for a couple of weeks with my friend, and it was really interesting just to like spend a fortnight in Tokyo and go to bars and go to maid cafes and just, you know, go to onsen, just do things, eat food, go to the fish market. And I think what we're seeing is like almost in a way what happens when we take convenience so far, right? So what I'm trying to say is like in Japan, they have a complete setup for the individual person flying solo. You know, you can literally like walk into a ramen bar, place an order on a machine, sit at a bar, and someone brings you the food, walks away. Like, you don't have to interact with people. Like, there's a vending machine for everything you could think of. Again, so you don't have to interact with people. And, you know, that in a way is optimizing for convenience. How can I get from A to B with the fewest points of friction and interactions? Or how can I acquire X without having to deal with that emotional labor of like making small talk and talking to someone. And I think maybe this is kind of like a cautionary tale for us and all of us wanting to like move towards convenience. Actually, like, we're inherently social.
Yeah.
That's our nature and that's how we survive. And, you know, we actually need to like resist what feels like idealness and convenience when we say, oh, I don't want to talk to someone. Oh God, I don't want to talk to the delivery driver. I don't want to talk to this taxi driver. I don't want to talk to the bus driver. Actually, interactions fuel us and connect us to something more meaningful, you know, because ultimately you just get to this existential crisis where you're like, wait, why am I even alive? Wait, yeah, good point. No good reasons. Bye, world.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think you might be right. I haven't really thought it through what is the causal link, but I have a few ideas. And I think social interaction, obviously, like you said, it's the fuel to life. Like, you need it. We are social creatures and we need a community and we need a tribe. But social interactions can be quite scary at times because I think people know deep down that they are afraid of rejection. And if you go into a social interaction with that fear, it's often easier just to be like, how do I get through this world if I have to speak to people? Because then no one can reject me or then no one can kind of judge me, right? Mm. I've seen it happen when people just go into that shell because it becomes easier to just like to go by in life without having to face that fear. So I understand why this has happened. And I have a personal theory that Japan isn't, we look at Japan and be like, oh, look at all these trends, like it's so strange. But I feel like they're just like 5-10 years ahead of us. And I feel like we'll see this more and more. I mean, I can't remember the actual stats, but how often do we hear like 1 in 5 people doesn't have a close friend to call, you know what I'm saying, in an emergency, or like only says they've got 2 or 3 close friends, like, or less than 2 or 3. And it's gone down consistently over the decades. Like, what's going on? Like, is it the internet? Is it just, you know, entertainment has become so good that we just don't need to, we can just get by without having to actually like chat to people now? Like, what do you think?
I also think that Japan, from what I have read, so I'd love for, you know, listeners there to chime in, has like very rigid like gender roles and gender expectations. I remember reading an article once about how a slur was passed in like a meeting between like Japanese executives. And one of the guys was basically made this comment that like a good working woman is a bad wife,
right,
or something like that. And I just wonder if there's a maybe like a correlation, you know, between intolerance for authentic identities, right? Because for us to be authentic, we have to be progressive. We have to be able to escape from traditions and norms, and a feeling of desolation and desperation, right? Because if you are living in a society that is very like deterministic in like who you should be based on your gender, based on your class, based on this, based on that, you know, it leaves you very little room to actually self-actualize on your own terms, right? Yeah. And I think, I like this idea of us kind of looking ahead as into Japan as like the vision of the future, but then maybe also like unpacking what is uniquely Japanese, or rather, what are some of the problematic themes within Japanese society that we also have and we can address. And I think, you know, this is a conversation we're having in the Western world as well. All of the jobs lost in the US economy in December, you know, that Time magazine article that went viral, were women. 100,000 jobs lost. The impact of this pandemic, which is still ongoing, is going to be decades in the making. And it's definitely setting back progress that we have made around gender equality in the workplace, right? Because with homeschooling and all this kind of stuff going on, women are going back into this caring role that's impacting their career development. Maybe they're even leaving their jobs. I don't know. I think we need to be really mindful about the role of individuals, the roles of individuals, and the ability and freedom we give to individuals to be themselves, you know, regardless of expectations based on their gender, their class, their this, their that, because that's what we really struggle with. And we see that happening right now. You know, women are kind of defaulting into that caregiver role when actually maybe we need to see women revolting against that and challenging husbands to step up. And maybe we as employees need to be challenging our employers and saying, can you be mindful of who you're laying off and make sure that it's 50-50? Because we can't have a whole generation of lost mom workers or whatever. I don't know. I feel like it's going to be, by the time we realize this, it's all going to be too late. But these are the things that I'm thinking of.
Yeah, the pandemic has definitely fucked shit up in that sense. And exacerbated a lot of those kind of gender inequities. And then also the loneliness factor as well. Like, how many people are just at home now, just like working by themselves? And as much as we're like, remote work, yay. Listen, remote work is isolating as hell. We said this like years ago on the previous episode, like remote work, it's all fun and games, but like, there isn't much of a workplace culture. Like, you're not really going to meet people and you're not really going to interact with folks. If you've got your own life set up with your partner and your kids, maybe don't care to, but if you're young, you can lose out on quite a formative time of meeting people.
What do you think as well about the link between status and loneliness. So the reason I ask this is because I think there's a lot of negative connotations around loneliness and having mental health problems. Right. And a lot of us, for us, success is status. You know, I've moved out of home, I'm building a career. Oh, I've got a promotion, I've got this, I've got that. That's the story that people want to hear. Yep. The story that people don't want to hear is, and that's come at a cost of building relationships with my friends, finding a significant other, investing in my own self. My life is my work. My life is chasing status. And now I'm lonely, but can I share that loneliness, or is that loneliness going to be a weakness? Is that loneliness going to put a shadow on the status and the success that I've reached? Do we as a society need to hold ourselves accountable to the fact that we are not letting people talk about their loneliness? Or when they do, we're shaming them.
Yeah, I don't know if there is a space to kind of have those kind of discussions. Do you know what I'm saying? And I remember going on Clubhouse recently, and there was a room saying, like, what if success doesn't bring you happiness? And I saw the title and I was like, isn't this kind of already settled? Like, didn't the Stoics and the Buddhists and all the ancient philosophies already know that? Don't we know that success doesn't bring you happiness and that it comes at a cost? Like, there is no, the universe doesn't give you nothing for free. And yeah, you can burn all your bridges and you will have the money and the thing at the end of it, but you might be lonely as hell. Like, I'm reminded of, you know, rest in peace, Tony Hsieh, like the founder of CEO of Zappos, who was a billionaire, super successful, was doing great work in LA. And he died. I think he became addicted to drugs, if I'm correct. And he died, apparently, according to all reports, very lonely. The only people around him were the people that he was paying. So status, high status, it probably is correlated with loneliness. Like, you might have a lot of people around you, but you're still lonely. You know what I'm saying? Like, how many people they actually give a fuck about you beyond what you can do for them?
And I think that's what we need to be willing to change. You know, something that I've been talking a lot about recently is like masculinity. And I think there are expectations within society, especially of men, that men can't show weakness. And then when they do, they get teased, they get mocked. And that's on us women too, right? Like, I'm not just saying men. Like, some of us, and you know, myself included, I've been guilty of this. I've held men in my life accountable to like outdated expectations. And you know, someone recently reminded me of this bell hooks quote, and you know, one of the things that bell hooks said is like, we should just love men for being men, not because they're providers, not because they're, you know, XYZ, but just because they are, you know, because that's what we want of ourselves. All of us just want to be loved just for being, right? Not a transactional kind of love. Oh, well, if you do this, then I love you, or you achieve that, then I love you. And I think that's the conversation that we as a society need to have. It's not just Japan, not just the US, it's not just the UK, like everywhere we are, we're still expecting people to prove their worth to us as if just being isn't enough.
Yeah, I mean, if you ever meet anybody in your life that accepts you in that kind of deep level, then just hold on to them, because so much of the world is transactional. It's like, what can you do for me, fam? Like, you know what I'm saying? You know, especially in the dating world, it's just like, can you provide? Are you attractive? Can you do this? Can you do that? And that's unfortunately the way of the world. And I think it's already getting further in that direction. You know what I'm saying? Like, even if you think about like how disposable, you know, these dating apps are, where you just swipe it through, and it's just like, you know, I'm sure you can build a deep connection on there, but is that the right foundation? I don't know. I'm not here to judge that in, but it does seem just very disposable. But yeah, that's the end of the philosopher segment. Abba, are you still using Clubhouse every now and then?
It's a mixed bag of quality, I will say. But every now and then, you know, I get bored. It's lockdown. I'll just see what's happening on there. So I want to play around with the Twitter version. I haven't had a chance yet.
Twitter Spaces, isn't it? Something like that, right? Have you used it?
Ain't nobody giving me access.
Okay. We're not pushing enough yet. Yeah, because, you know, you hear some people saying that, you know, Clubhouse might be the end of podcasts, that it might supersede podcasts. Yeah, so they asked Daniel Ek, who's the Spotify CEO. Obviously, Spotify is big on podcasts. I think they've spent near enough like $1 billion in the last year on like podcast apps, podcast exclusives. So they've got all in on it. And he says that basically he doesn't think it will, just because it's an interesting format from a creator's perspective, but for consumption, it's terrible because people want it to be on demand and not, you know, oh, at 7 p.m., you got to go in and listen and be there. Because I think outside of lockdown, who's spending all that time listening to, I don't know, do you get what I'm saying here?
I'm definitely not the target market. Like, I realize this very early on. I mean, we had that like techish Clubhouse room on Saturday, and then like we just left.
Yeah, just rambled on, bruv. It was just rambling. I was like, no, I'm out, man.
It's just interesting because I do think that like we sometimes forget, you know, like Taylor Swift famously left Spotify. I think the relationship between creators and Spotify is a very different relationship to the consumers and Spotify.
Yeah.
And I'm definitely like OG Spotify fan. Like, I remember signing up for the beta. But when I interact with people in the music industry, you know, they don't like Spotify. They think Spotify is super exploitative. You know, Spotify is like a unicorn company. It's made its founders billionaires, but at what cost, right? Because yes, there's like a significant number of people maybe who have done well, but the majority of musicians haven't.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've got homies in the music industry as well. And Spotify is, it's definitely a mixed bag. You know, you've got to really have like millions of downloads in order to make maybe like $1,000 or something crazy like that.
But I don't think Clubhouse and Spotify are going to, like, they're not competitors. I mean, Clubhouse is just so random. It's literally a lottery. And I guess to some extent, you know, that's the joy of it and the spontaneity. It's definitely right now catering to a West Coast audience. I know a lot of people are excited because people like Elon Musk have been on there and stuff like that. I can't catch them. Elon Musk was going to be live at like 2 a.m. my local time. I was like, I'm all right. So I think, yeah, like I can't imagine someone like going for a run and listening to Clubhouse. Maybe they do. I don't know. I'm not a power user for sure. But yeah, I still think like it's going to be, you know, on demand, people like walking to the kitchen, asking Alexa to put on whatever podcast or whatever track. I think that's how I see folks continuing to engage with audio. And I also think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens to Clubhouse when like freedom of movement returns and lockdown periods end. Like they just so lucky with timing that they just picked a time where everyone was so friggin' bored, couldn't go anywhere, and tired of looking at screens. So what do you have? Great, audio-only engagement. Like how many people wanted to socialize but couldn't bear to be on another Zoom call, and then Clubhouse just filled the void? Like sometimes you go on Clubhouse, there's just like two people in a room. Yeah. It's literally just like a friend realized another friend was online. It's like, oh, cool, hey. Like instead of calling them, like, oh, hey, what's up? So I think it's going to be really interesting to see how they try and survive.
So I know Twitter's got their own, they've got a clone version. Facebook's doing a clone version. So that's another like danger zone for them. Will they be able to survive?
The minute Instagram does a clone, they're dead.
You think so? I mean, Snap survived. Snap survived, but yeah, it definitely did take
a with a completely different generation. Like Snap,
yeah,
I mean, you know, really interesting, do some kind of like demographic slices of like largest, you know, customer base for all of those different platforms. But yeah, like I, you know, let's see. I mean, even if you think of how Clubhouse discovery works right now, I'm on Twitter, someone I follow on Twitter is saying they're going to be on a Clubhouse room or DMing me to join a Clubhouse room. I go from Twitter to that platform, then I jump back onto Twitter to start talking about what happened in the room. I mean, the minute I can just do all of that on Twitter, why would I navigate away?
Absolutely. And then you've also got your own follower base on Twitter as well. Like you've got, you know, however many followers. It's going to be a bit long to go on Clubhouse and rebuild it up, basically. So if you've got like a million followers, why would you do that? But yeah, I think Daniel Elk made a good statement, which is that from a creator's perspective, there's a lot of spontaneity and you can invite people up to the audience and it's real fun. But from a consumer, it's just like, and a consumption perspective, I just want to go on and like listen to what I know is there and like on my time, not when it's like, oh yeah, 2 a.m. in LA like time, Elon's online. I'm too busy. I can't do that. I got sleep. You know what I'm saying? And then the other thing is what I do think it will damage is I think podcasts that are not that well edited. Like, there's a lot of podcasts where it's like 3 hours of people
rambles. Rambling. Like the first episode of Techish.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, say no more. And like if it's like not very well edited, if there's not kind of, you know, if it's not a controlled product, like if it's not, I don't know what the word I'm looking to describe is, but like if it's not a crafted product where like there's, you know, you've taken out the boring parts and you've, you know, made sure the interesting things are just in there and it's not just awkward silences, that kind of podcast will struggle against Clubhouse, I think, because it's very much one and the same. Like the experience is the same. Whereas I think heavily edited editorial podcasts will be fine. But let's watch this space. It's going to be an interesting time once lockdown is over.
Let's see,
man. So just a quick report actually that came out. So Donald Glover is working with Amazon now. I think the show Atlanta is still with FX, but he's basically working on multiple projects for them that will be on Amazon Prime.
Yes.
And then the thing that actually...
Amazon Prime actually getting a good show. Nice.
Yeah, there we go. And I think they're actually going to give him... They're going to give him his own content channel. So essentially, it'll be a content channel where he will have his own shows and then the shows that he likes. And this will appear on his own channel. I think this is quite clever because I think we've gone so far in the direction of algorithms that sometimes the pendulum has to swing back the other way and go back to creation. So like if Donald Glover's like, yo, these are the 5 or 6 handpicked shows that I fuck with and these are free shows that I have made. The thing is actually, like, I had a friend of mine that met Donald and hanged out with him for quite some time. Like, just he was randomly in an Eritrean restaurant in London while he was filming Star Wars, and he was sort of the most friendliest dude ever. So I might have to holler at them so we can get this Tekka show on Amazon Prime real quick. But anyway, I think it's just, I think there is algorithm fatigue. Do you know what I'm saying? I think I would like someone to be like, yo, man, these are the shows that I fuck with. You trust me, so have a look. So let's see. I look forward to that. Maybe more creators will get that kind of hub, their own channel on these platforms. Like,
I think that would be so cool. You know, curation is really on the rise. I'm seeing it in a lot of different spaces right now. So for example, like one of our listeners, Andrea Hernandez, has launched her own newsletter where she's trying to like, you know, pick up on product trends before they happen, whether that's like, I don't know, CBD sex products or something like that. And more retailers are actually thinking like, oh, how can I like be super mindful with like the collection of stuff that I present so that every single thing is bang on the money and bang on taste and irreplaceable or irreplicable. I don't know the word. And it's really interesting because it reminds me of a fashion e-commerce startup that has like since pivoted, but I actually think was too early, called semaine, like the French word for week. And the whole concept behind that, honestly, I just thought it was so clever, but I was too broke at the time to really benefit from it. But what they would do is they would take like a woman. So she might be like, oh, hi, I run my own architecture firm, or, oh, I'm an exec at this fund. And they would get her to basically share her style. Like, you know, what's kind of like your typical style, your ideal style. And then that would be what's on sale.
Yeah.
So they might bring me on and I'd be like, oh, you know, you're like, you never see me without my Converse, pair of high-waisted light jeans. This is my favorite leather jacket. This is my favorite silk blouse. These are my favorite gold earrings. And I loved that because one week I'd be like, oh my God, yes, I want everything. And another week I'd be like, oh no, that's not me, but that's so my friend Fran. And, you know, I forwarded it onto her. And like, I just thought that that was so clever because how many times do you like go online to shop for something like a product, you know, shoes, top, whatever, spend like literally an hour scrolling through endless websites. You never find anything you like.
Yeah.
But then here you find someone and you're like, oh my God, I like the way she's paired that. That style makes a lot of sense. The philosophy behind why this is a much loved piece, I resonate with. Oh, easy to wash or blah, 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 blah. I trust that. Boom, I'm buying it all. Like suddenly the decision is made. So I just think we're hopefully going to see not just more of that in the media, like you've pointed out, but just like across every vertical.
Yeah, like that's a great startup idea. Someone should really redo that again. I don't know why that one failed. I mean, sometimes you're just too early, you know what I mean? And the idea can be done again at a later time. The other idea that I think somebody should do is sometimes if you're looking for like, you know, a piece of hardware or any kind of electronic or any product, you know, you go into Amazon, you type it in and it's like 1,000 versions of like that specific product.
Yeah.
And like, surely there should be a site. Maybe it exists where somebody's like, here are the three best. That's it. You want a
dishwasher?
Here
that.
Are the three best. Here's the two best, you know,
wire cutter.
Yeah, whatever thing you can imagine. And you could just do it across the 100 most popular products people tend to buy and say, we've done the reviews, we've worked out, you know, here are the three best and here are the links to purchasing them, right? Like, because sometimes like it's tiring looking through. And obviously they're going to be the expensive products because these are the three best. But if you're building a business and you want to kind of sell to high-end people, probably that's the way to do it. Just be like, yo, you want the best jumper? This is it, whatever. So yeah.
I mean, this is what your stocks was going to be. I think it's on hiatus, which is a shame because I was super excited about
that. That's the product hunt company, basically the product that they developed, right?
Yeah. So the idea was like you would stack your best X. This is the best this. This is the best that.
Yeah.
But anyway, we shall see.
I think it's difficult to pull off. That's probably why, to get that kind of traction, maybe. One quick story just like that is that probably gets filed under no shit. We all knew this anyway, but there's basically been a deathbed letter confession from an undercover police officer or FBI agent who acknowledges the role that the FBI and the NYPD played in the assassination of Malcolm X.
Oh.
So he was basically one of the undercover agents saying that it was my job to make sure that there was no security on the day of the assassination.
Wow.
To get his security away. So they obviously knew what was going to go down and either aided or abetted or, you know, made sure that nothing could be stopped. I think most people in the kind of quote-unquote conscious community were aware of this, but it's good to kind of have that conclusive proof because it's so often easy to be kind of downplayed. I went and saw Judas and the Black Messiah. I recommend everyone to go watch it. And you see that dynamic take place there where FBI, you know, consciously had Fred Hampton assassinated. Everybody go watch that.
We're going to see, fast forward 10 years from now, Capitol Hill insurrection, deathbed confession. Yeah, the reason there was only one black man holding down the fort was because...
Yeah, listen, but the thing is, they wait long enough until no one really cares or no one's really alive enough to kind of, you know, think this is almost like 50 years, you know, in the making.
Tisk, tisk.
Yeah, and then the other thing, one last thing. Listen, I'm not a medical professional.
You're not? Dr. Mike?
I'm not a doctor. I don't play one on TV either. So consult your doctor. But I've seen enough studies now where I feel confident to say this is what I'm doing personally. And you can talk to your doctor if you also want to do this. But essentially, there is a correlation or there seems to be a correlation between low vitamin D levels and COVID. And the only reason why I mention this on a podcast is because I know a lot of us are either black or brown or from, you know, the African continent or whatever. And we're living in the Western society and we tend to have low vitamin D levels. I know I do.
I do, yes.
Yeah. And they're now saying that there's potentially, this is one of the partial reasons among many, many others why, you know, Black people and people of color have been so disproportionately affected by COVID. Obviously, there's other reasons like frontline workers, you know, different types of jobs and whatnot. But one factor is if you've got low vitamin D, I really recommend you take a supplement. And the only reason why I'm doing this now is because I think like the research that I've done has showed that it's pretty harmless if you take a vitamin D supplement. Like I wouldn't recommend something that was risky, right? Mm. But there seems to be no downside to it. So do your own homework, do your own research. I'll put the studies in the show notes. But yeah, I thought that would be a word of warning. Are you taking your supplements, Abba?
Thank you for reminding me because I'm living in a country that's dark a lot of the time.
Dark, cold as well.
Dark and cold. But my peoples, you know, come from lands that are sunny and bright. And I didn't realize that dark skin can't process vitamin D as efficiently because we're flooded with it, right? If you actually think of it anthropologically, like we didn't need to. Whereas in colder, darker countries, people's skin had to be like, oh, vitamin D, catch it, hold it. Don't know when we'll find it again. And it was years that I'd been living in the UK before a doctor pointed out to me, like literally did a blood work and was just like, are you tired all the time? And I was like, I don't think any more than the average 20-something person. He's like, yeah, you need vitamin D. And then he explained that to me. And I was like, all this time, I never knew. So yeah, it's so good to know for us darker skinned people. Thanks for the tip, bruv.
Yeah, everyone stay safe.
All right, everybody, that brings us to the end of another episode of Techish. Thank you so much for listening. As always, why don't you leave us a review before you go? Always love to hear from you. Did you know that we are on Twitter and Instagram too with our own dedicated channel at Techish Pod? So if you haven't hit the follow button on Instagram, open the app now. Get your finger out, hit that follow, Techish Pod, and I'll see you there.
Ciao. Bye.